Hey everybody, Nate here. Before the show, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about our sponsor, the Snack Nanny. The Snack Nanny is the latest, greatest spill-proof bowl. It's the first snack bowl for kids with a self-closing door. The Snack Nanny allows kids to snack freely without overeating, keeps kids entertained, and prevents them from creating a mess for mom and dad to clean up. Kids and parents love the Snack Nanny. It's easy to use, easy to clean, and includes portion control features that only the Snack Nanny offers. To order, go to www.snacknanny.com or order through Amazon. Remember, you support our sponsors, and they support us. Thanks, and Nihei Dibiru. Hey everybody, and welcome back to Chop Talk. This is your host, Nate England. Today's show is part two of my interview with Peter Benson. Peter is the senior consultant with Greyhead Consulting, who focuses on management coaching, strategy facilitation, business plan development, and market research for businesses of any size. In part two, we keep the conversation going on South African politics and, of course, martial arts. But Peter also shares a couple stories about getting mugged in London and his part in the development of Engen, which has become the largest oil company in South Africa. Peter's wife, Anne, also jumps in with a few stories about dealing with the African DMV. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show.
But I then dashed through the little village, snuck up behind, waited an opportunity, shot across, jumped over the barrier on the Zambian side, physically grabbed the passport entry stamp from the Zambian official and stamped my own passport. And then said to them, they can do what they like with me. I'm now officially in Zambia. But I mean, without that type of training, I would have died in the middle of Africa. I mean, I had instances in Togo, and I've had instances in the Sudan and Chad. In fact, also, but it's not just Africa, in London. I've had them.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What happened in London?
In London, one evening, there were a group of us from Mobil Oil. We were on a course, and I was one of the lone guys staying at a hotel quite further in London City itself. In fact, north, let's call it north of Oxford Street.
Okay.
Versus the Thames. So I walked down. We all went out to pubs that evening, and we had a great time, a really great time. 3 o'clock in the morning, we now decide we've got to get to our hotels because we've got meetings the next morning. So, much to my disgust...
So it was an early night.
Correct. The two other people I was with, their hotels were one block away from where we were drinking, in the pub. By this stage, I didn't have a clue where my hotel was. I could see the Thames, okay, and I could see Big Ben, and I knew my hotel was north of that.
Okay.
My hotel was on a street called Bond Street. Okay? So I thought, okay, now I'm on my own. Taxis don't like stopping at 3 o'clock in the morning in London. Somehow, I don't know.
They don't know what's wrong. What's wrong?
Buzz past and gone. They're always all busy. You could never get. So I spot this little street called New Bond Street. Logic tells me New Bond must be close or goes into Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it must be an extension of Old Bond or whatever.
Right.
So, I get on this New Bond Street. I am 14 sheets to the wind. Pissed as a coot. Staggering through London. 3:30 now in the morning. And I stagger up. And I still can't find the Bond Street. But I'm still on New Bond. So, we keep going. And I'm staggering past the various alleyways and shop things. And the next minute, a fellow jumps out in front of me with a flick knife. Stands in front of me and in his Cockney accent, asked me for my wallet.
Give me your wallet, Gubner.
I was so...
Did he call you Gubner?
No, give me your wallet. Yeah. Oh. I was so pissed. I looked at him. Remember saying to him, where I come from, that's a toothpick. You need a gun to stop me. And I pushed him aside. Staggered another block up, and so happens to be, there was my hotel. The concierge, who's now staying at the door. Hey! See, one shot. But that the concierge looks back at me and he says, "Sir, do you know what's just happened?" And I said to him, I'll never forget, remember saying to him, "Yes, I'm pissed and I need to get to bed quickly because I've got a meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning." He says, "No, sir, someone tried to hold you up." I said, "Impossible. Can't hold me up, I'm too drunk." He says, "No, sir, someone pulled a knife on you." "They did?" I said, "We." I turned around and looked. This would-be mugger was still standing a block away in the middle of the road with his knife in his hand, with his mouth open, still staring at me walking into the hotel. So even while pissed, my training had given me the confidence. Mm. Okay, if you want to try and stick me with... I mean, he had the knife out.
Right.
So he wasn't like doing this. He had the knife out, thinking that was a threat.
He was, "I have a knife."
Yeah, "I have a knife. You've got nothing."
Right.
I was just pissed. I just told him, "You need a gun. You can't do that to me with a knife. Because in a knife fight, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to hurt you badly if you try and do that to me."
I always remember also when we went up to Zim that time and we were at the Bartbridge border post and it was absolutely chaotic. I think it was a long weekend or something and there must have been 5,000 people at that border post. And it really is chaotic. There's no signs, there's no nothing. You have to have registration papers for your cars, you have to pay here for car tax and all sorts of... And we got there and there were people milling. As far as you could see, we were the only white faces. So we were with that friend of ours from London University, the professor of English literature. So he lives in quite a rarefied atmosphere. And we finally, we stand there for about an hour. We finally get inside the room where they stamp your passports.
But people are pushing in all over.
Now all these taxi drivers are arriving with like 20 passports from the people inside their taxis. And there's people pushing in and... People know the people behind the counter, so they're pushing into the front. We got into this room, and there were thousands of people in there. And suddenly, this whole wave of taxi drivers arrived with passports, and we're pushing in, and you could hardly breathe. It was just a little room the size of this patio. And they were pushing into the front, and there was like no queue, because Africans don't queue. They just like push.
Survival of the fittest.
Exactly.
Even when you're trying to get your passport.
No, it is. So suddenly Pete like draws himself up to his full height and he walks to the front. Now there's also armed guards all over the place and security prisoner grabs these two taxi drivers who'd walked into these piles of passports and grips them and says, "Get back in the queue." And he turns around and he says, "What? Get in an orderly queue." And it's going, "Oh God, it's going to be the Battle of Isandlwana all over again." And I promise you, within 10 minutes, we had our passport stamped through.
Listen,
oh my God.
But you see, there again, I put it back to the martial arts. So when people are talking about martial arts as far as a fighting thing, it's not.
Mm.
It's because I was confident in myself to be able to know that I could handle a car of 1,000 of these guys.
And Alan's going, "Oh God, he's going to get himself killed. How are we going to get back?"
But I did the same thing recently at the traffic department.
Yes, no, you did.
We have to renew our driver's license every 5 years.
Mm.
Walked into the traffic
it's
department.
It's just a money thing. You don't have to do anything. They just give you a new photo and that's it.
Yeah, but Africans just, they don't like formality.
And they don't queue.
No, formal ways of doing things.
Mm.
Us whites or Western educated people
are
grown up with organizers.
This is how you do it.
Correct. I arrive now to go and renew my license. There are hundreds of people in this building. Everybody's going everywhere and anywhere.
No signs.
No signs, anything. So I do the same one of those numbers. I look for a guy who I thought looks like an employee at this licensing department. Call him over. Big black African guy. Call him over. Tell him that, listen, he must organize this properly. He just looked at me blankly. And
this is organized.
Yeah.
Yes.
What are you talking about?
This is a good day.
It took me about 5 minutes. But I had everybody in proper queues. I found out what everybody needed to do. I've gone to each of these supervisors and said, okay, what do you do here? I know he renews licenses. Okay, all those who need to renew licenses, go stand there. Okay, all those applying for new licenses, right, you go there. All those for eye tests, you go there. I'd organize that whole department. Put in my application, left.
No, mine took 3 months, and I had to phone like 5 times to find out.
Mine, within 3 weeks... I get a notice to say it's back.
And it normally takes minimum 6 weeks.
And they offered you a new job.
Well, I walked in and he asked whether I could not stay. He says, since I've been here and they've kept the same type of rules, he says, Mr. Benson, it is working. It is working properly now. It's going smoothly.
I still said to him, how did you get your thing so fast? Because, yeah, I know. Well, they know my name. I took 3 months and I had to go up there like 5 times because they couldn't find it.
I refuse to bribe anybody. I will not bribe anybody. My rule is, listen, there's logic. The world works on logic and respect for one another. And if you can do that, we can get things done. That's all you need. It's basic principles.
And I'll never forget Alan's face at that bike bridge. Oh my God. He was horrified. He was convinced you were going to get killed.
But go back to the military service. It was, it was or is compulsory in South Africa.
It was.
So was. Everybody, you had to go in.
Every white male above the age of 17 was
straight from a trick.
Seconded into the army.
Okay.
If you refused, you were then arrested and jailed.
And there was some stuff going on. Now I don't think
there was the Angolan War, the Southwest African War.
I fought in all of
them. I'm not entirely sure what we were fighting, but you know, at the time there was they used to call it the Rooi. They were fighting the communists, the Rooi Gevaar, which was the red danger.
Red danger, yeah.
And then the Swart Gevaar was the black danger. That was what they were fighting. And they were so indoctrinated, those boys in the army.
Mm.
I mean, anything black that moved was a complete.
But you see, now there's the danger of the education system.
No, they were so indoctrinated.
Mm. Politicians brainwash your citizens through the education system.
Mm. It was.
Now, it was only when we were by the age of 20, 21, where you started to really question what you were actually taught at school. And suddenly you thought, well, this doesn't gel.
Mm.
What real life is versus what you were taught. No, no, you were taught something very different. I mean, you were fundamentally taught that they walked around with forked tails and horns coming out of their heads. That's basically the way you were taught. You were taught from their Calvinistic Bible that said anybody that isn't them is inferior to them, fundamentally.
And they had to do a year service, so they kept changing it. That went from a year to 2 years, they kept it, and then they had to do camps, like 3 weeks a year of camps.
So it was like the reserves of the U.S.
Yes, afterwards. Yeah. You became then an active citizen force. I mean, I had the misfortune of being in Angola during war, being in, then it was Southwest Africa, which now in Namibia. Also in when it was Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, and also in Mozambique.
Wow. And they were just fighting in France. And I don't know, I still don't to this day, not entirely sure what they were fighting. But
they were fighting somebody or something.
But there were a lot of injuries, you know. There were a lot of boys, because they were boys, they were 17.
That's why I won't talk much about that.
There's still a lot of people who are very scarred by that experience.
I mean, yeah, I've become racialistic. I dislike Afrikaners.
Does, which was why I was so horrified when Tam married one. But
yeah.
But Zito's actually very English.
But I mean, we all complain now what the current government is doing on nepotism and giving jobs for buddies and families and incompetence. But that actually happened exactly the same with the Nats when they came into power. Because the English speakers were forced out of positions to put Afrikaans speakers in.
They had secret societies. They had the Broederbond, which was a heavy, high-level Afrikaans secret society, which ruled the country. That Broederbond ruled the country. Wow. I mean, it was quite scary, the power that they had.
It's like in the US, it's your lobbyists who've got the power.
Same thing.
Not the politicians, the guys who've got the money.
Mm-hmm. The Broederbond ruled the country.
Yeah. But, you know, I think also, you know, look, the nationalist, he was misunderstood to a large extent of what he was trying to achieve.
Okay.
I think if it went its full route, yeah, the rest of the world saw it as non-humane, but because they were seeing it from a distance rather than from here. Here, even today, you'll hear people talking. The education system was far better under the old government than it is under the new. Now, I'm talking about the blacks themselves. So, and even under the old days, you really had two separate education systems. You had what they call a Bantu education system and then a so-called white upper class education system.
They ran them separately.
Now, yeah, we saw that this Bantu education really wasn't up to par. So there was a lot of, let's say, direction against that, and there were riots and all sorts of things. But now with the new government, that so-called education of the disadvantaged is actually worse off than what it was in the previous. Now, you can't have that. I mean, the ANC came into power with all these beautiful theories and promises about a rainbow nation, a universal, but now we have a BEE. Now, people like myself, I have retired early deliberately to get out of paying bloody taxes.
No, seriously.
Yeah. Why? And then also because I was a white middle-aged male, I was told categorically, because my next step was being a board director member of a major board.
Okay.
I was told I couldn't be because I was white.
Hey everybody, remember, if you have an upcoming seminar, tournament, or other martial arts event, let us know and we'd be happy to announce it on the program. And now, back to the show.
Wow.
And they brought in guys from the disadvantaged areas and races, put them in as my bosses, and told me that I had to train them, I had to help them, I had to make the decisions for them.
To make their really big salary.
Correct. And I was paid lower than what they were. Now, I wouldn't have minded doing it if they paid me exactly what they were paying those guys.
Right.
But no. So then I said, no, listen. This just doesn't work. You're window dressing. You're not empowering people. Mm-hmm. You're just making me angry. So I'm not going to leave my knowledge behind. Since I've retired, though, my whole consultancy work is all about empowerment. Is how do I leave knowledge behind in companies?
But you can do that because it's sort of freelance work. You could do that with the people who are interested. The people that want this.
Yes.
And you'll be surprised the number of South African, let's call them blacks, who have come to me and said they need me to teach them. But this is not at junior levels. This is all at senior levels. Mm. This is all at board levels. And
catapulted into these positions. And
they have realized themselves that they are not, they may be getting big bucks, but they're not achieving anything in themselves. In fact, they need to get out of those positions quickly before anybody finds out the mistakes that they made. This is what's happened.
They're trying to move up the ladder as fast as possible.
Correctly, and get away.
Yes.
Now, a lot of those guys have realized that that's not the way to go for the future. Mm. They do need to be empowered. Mm. And people like myself are called in.
There's a lot of mentorship. Yeah.
So I now mentor very senior members, black guys, who are just saying that we need this knowledge.
Right.
That has not been given by their companies. But all of this, I can base. I've got two foundations. One is my financial background that gave me strength in business, and my martial arts in the discipline, in being able to handle situations and put them out logically. And really, that's where it's going to go. So I'm out of the economy,
okay,
fundamentally, because it's sick when you see what is going on. I mean, I was a career oriented. I was the youngest director of
personality.
Yeah, the youngest director of Mobil, the age of 32.
Wow.
So I'd achieved a lot and very quickly, and I wanted to empower. So when 1994 came in, I used to sit down with our big companies and say, right, guys, this is how you empower. But you've got a capitalistic slant. Capitalist slant says I'm going for profit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in order to empower, you needed to then say, okay, for 10 years, I'm going to increase my manpower at a cost, keep my experience, and make sure that there is not a sudden big bang move across, but let's empower those who have been disadvantaged with using the guys with skills. But that hasn't happened.
Get them all up to the higher level where they know how to either operate the machinery or know how to run the company or whatever level they're at.
But capitalism was saying profit was the driver. Therefore, with profit being the driver, cost pressures were always there. So you couldn't go readily and increase your costs in companies by increasing your manpower. That's not going to be productive for a while because it's got to be empowered and trained and mentored and grown into the organization. All we've done is taken these guys straight and put them straight into it, and they now feel themselves disenfranchised because they've gone in. What do you say? You are promoted to a position beyond your capability or your competence.
And that's a scary feeling.
Correct.
Oh, of course.
Even as an individual yourself. Those guys who are educated and know are suddenly now becoming so stressed because they know they have not got the right tools to cope in their senior positions. So who do they run around looking for a white middle-aged male to come and help and mentor them.
You guys did quite a bit with, you're telling me that when ExxonMobil pulled out, the group of you got together and...
When we formed Engen.
Yeah.
That was actually a world beater. Mm. We were able, a group of us who were with Mobil, who didn't stay with Mobil when Mobil decided to pull out. Then came back in and formed this new company called Engen, which bought the Mobil assets in Southern Africa. It is now the only place in the world that, let's call it a so-called national independent, is larger than the international boys.
Because that's like what you see driving around. You see the Engen stations. Yeah.
Now, the closest international boy to Engen is Shell at the moment. Now, Engen here in South Africa has got about roughly 30% of the market. Mm. The next is Shell, which is the large international, has got 18% of the market.
So they're still...
So we achieved something that was everybody told us was not achievable anywhere. Mm. You could not beat the big internationals at their own game.
You did it anyway.
We did it.
That's a hell of a...
We proved that we can do it. We morphed their brands. We brought it in. Our technology, we kept up to date. We scoured the world. Yeah, we hunted. Mm. Now, remember the sanctions we were on.
Mm.
So, yeah, we were hunting.
Still in the 80s.
Yeah, people like myself would hunt the world, and we would select the best technology from various parts of the world. Then we brought it back to South Africa, and we combined it all. So we have unique offerings, unique technologies that were designed here within South Africa purely because of the sanctions. So that brought out the other side of us as South Africans, that the innovation side, the ability to work hard, to fight your competitor, and then not be scared. Not be scared of how big your competitor is. Still tackle it. So we gave them bloody noses, yeah.
And they still haven't recovered.
They haven't recovered. No, Engine will become, they have got a goal. They will become the largest within the African continent.
Wow.
Their main competitor on the African continent is Total Alfina, that group.
Okay.
They are very big in Africa. Engine's goal is that they will overtake them. And yep, they will do it by 2016, is the plan.
Wow.
Now, that was a plan that we called Plan 2016. That I was instrumental in developing 7 years ago.
So that wasn't something that came up with last February or something like that?
This has been in the boil for a long time.
Going back to what you talked about, sort of, what are the long-term goals? How do you...
We look at sustainability and not at the quick profit. Now, I'm glad that Engine then formed a relationship with Malaysians or the East. Because the philosophy in the East is very different. Your Western philosophy being capitalism is dividend to dividend. You actually suffer long-term sustainability. Because you can make a quick buck. Any CEO can come in, make a quick buck by slashing costs. So suddenly this year's dividends and profit is great. In 3 years' time, because he slashed costs in the wrong place, now the company suffers. But he's no longer there. He got paid fat bonuses and is gone.
He's on his yacht. He doesn't care what happens. It's on to the next guy, I guess, to figure out.
So we are trying, and that is more of an Eastern philosophy. They try and look 20 to 25 years ahead in their planning. And try and plan for 20 or 20. Now, no one in business, you don't know. No one's got such a good crystal ball that'll tell you exactly what the world economy, globalization is going to be like in 5 years' time, let alone 20 years' time. But we use scenario planning. And we would take alternative routes, whether we take it what we call the high road or the low road or the middle road.
But you had a plan in place to know that when you hit that, junction...
Between the various scenarios. That's exactly how we did it. And that actually has... put us in great stead.
Yeah, seems like it.
No, we were invited all over Europe and the UK to come in and do presentations of how we did it. Now, what was our philosophy? How do you actually move 3,000 people in a total different direction from where they were? Now, remember, we were very comfortable under Mobil. Mobil was this enormous big brother. Enormous. I mean, just their R&D division has 300 fully qualified chemists. Their representatives on the road, their minimum qualifications are BSE engineering degree people. Now, we had to compete with that, where our R&D department, you know, at one stage we started out only had five people in it.
And one of them was a janitor.
Exactly. And then the tea lady was the other one. So we actually had three actually productive guys. So it was enormous challenges, very exciting times for us.
Yeah.
Big growth. We learned a lot.
Yeah.
And I think a number of other companies worldwide learned from us of how to... In fact, we are known as the masters of change management. So, whereas a lot of corporates don't like to change.
No, if this is what's in place and this is what is that is working, and if we change it, it might work better, but if we change it, it might work worse, so we're not going to mess with it.
Whereas the South Africans have had changes forced onto them, where they've had to adapt. So we've actually, in fact, you find it among a number of my peers who are what we call strategic marketers, that we actually get extremely bored if we have not fundamentally changed direction or business model after 3 or 5 years. We are constantly looking for change. And now that is a big advantage.
Yeah.
That's why we lose so many, the brain drain here, and if this country is not careful, it's going to lose more of those brains. And they're going to be snapped up by the UK, Canada, Australia, all the first world countries who are getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And they need this young talent to come in. And they're not growing their young talent.
No, that's a thing you see in the U.S., especially on the engineering side and the technical side, you have people coming in from India, from China, from anywhere else, and that's who the companies are hiring. Because you're right, they're not growing it at home.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting a little bit too comfortable,
and then chasing the buck. And this is what capitalism does. Capitalism has done. It's actually one of the worst harms that it's done to the U.S. itself. Look at your labor forces. I mean, most of your goods now are actually manufactured outside of the USA.
Yeah.
They're manufactured in China and Korea and everywhere else, but in the bloody USA. Mm-hmm. So therefore, US citizens become unemployed because a capitalist says, I want more margin on this pair of shoes. I'm not happy at 50%. Mm-hmm. I want an 80% margin. Mm-hmm. So, hey, let's go and find cheap slave labor where, yeah, we'll shout human rights, but hey, we're going to look the other way where we'll buy t-shirts from India where there's, 47 10-year-olds slogging away in a sweatshop making t-shirts.
Right.
I mean, sick.
So they're pushing towards a line where the jobs get shipped over, and all of a sudden, who the hell's going to buy your stuff? Because the people that were making it and could buy it no longer have a job.
Correct. And the USA economy is a fundamental consumer economy.
Yeah. Well, and then, like I mentioned, you guys are having the strikes here, but the same thing with the UAW. Caterpillar's big in Peoria, in my hometown.
Yeah.
And so every time the contract comes up, these guys go on strike, and they're making pretty good money for guys who didn't necessarily get the best education, don't have a ton of marketable skills. They're doing pretty good for themselves, but all of a sudden we're going to go on strike for an extra quarter, and guess what happens? Oh, we decided to close down this factory. We're opening it in Mexico. We're moving this operation to China.
Now, I remember the last time, well, not the last time, a couple of visits ago, going to Pretoria, Peoria, mm-hmm. and virtually the whole town was closed down.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the strike at Caterpillar.
Yes.
And all the talk amongst everybody in the town was the strike at Caterpillar, because families are reliant on it. And the same thing here. Here you've got the strikes. But the problem here is you've got guys now who, because jobs are scarce, are unemployment. I mean, really, they tell us sits at 25%. It's more like 40% that the unemployment is. Now, they're fundamentally, because of the education system has let them down, they are illiterate, uneducated, yet all they can really do is menial, hard, let's call it hard labor, part of the labor, but now they want to be paid at a level of someone who actually is literate, who can add, who can read, and we all say, oh yes, shame, they need to. Agree. But what's going to happen to those mines? They're going to do exactly what you just said about what Caterpillar.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to close down certain shops.
Right.
Because no longer, because now their whole cost has moved up.
Right.
They're going to say, well, we're only getting X dollars per ton or per ounce of whatever is coming out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, guys, we're closing down that shop. And sorry, 200 of you now, suddenly unemployed.
Right.
So capitalism is not the answer to the world. But it's one of the answers, but it's a combination.
Mm-hmm.
It's not kick out capitalism. No, never. Mm. Capitalism has some very good, strong points. But it has some really ugly, let's say, after effects.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make so much margin that we will pollute and plunder the resources, irrespective of what is left behind. Now, you can go in parts of this country and you can see where, prior to all the legislation that was brought in about rehabilitation and everything else, and look at old mining areas and quarry areas, all it really looks like rape and pillage. I mean, big gaping holes in the earth, vegetation destroyed, animal life destroyed. Now they're talking about coal mining in the Kruger National Park. Sure. fundamentally foul to chase what? The dollar.
Or the rand in this case.
In the rand. Well, no, we still chase the dollar.
Oh, you do. Okay,
all our commodities are in dollar denominated. Whether it be our gold, we buy in dollars. That's still chasing the dollar. Yeah, we'd like it now to get more dollars because we'll get more rands. Hmm. I mean, our currency is going through
the
toilet.
Yeah, you guys are going down. I should have waited to exchange.
You should have waited until this week.
Next time you have to give me a loan until the last day.
Exactly, until it changes. I mean, now you're getting 9 rand to the dollar. I mean, our rand buys the same as what your dollar buys in the US. Your dollar, you go into a shop with $1.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy bits of chewing gum and a few sweet. Our rand, you can do exactly the same.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, and that does it for part 2 of my interview with Peter Benson. I'd just like to thank Peter again for taking the time to sit down and talk with me, and of course for all the help during my time in South Africa. As always, if you have any questions, please send them to choptalkwithnateengland@gmail.com. Thanks again, and mataya.
Give me your wallet, Gabna.